known for her work in Mycoplasma genitalium as much as anything else. And that really has informed a lot of her work looking at molecular analyses, particularly in men with non-gonococcal urethritis, and she's going to share some of that work with us today. Very, very fortunate to have Lisa talk to us today. So go ahead.
Thank you, Jeannie. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank you all for being up early in the morning, particularly given the appearance of Johnny Depp last night. I hope you all got a chance to meet with him. Yeah, Jeannie's got a really nice picture of herself with Jack Sparrow. I'd also like to start off by saying it's just such a huge privilege to be here this morning among this group with Rebecca and Christina, and to have been invited by both Sevgi and Jeannie. Sevgi was actually one of my very first mentors and taught me virtually everything I know about behavioral epidemiology of STDs, and I'm actually going to talk a little bit about behavioral epidemiology. And, of course, Jeannie has been just an incredible leader at the University of Washington, and we really miss you. So I'm going to finish up the session today by talking about the other half, talking about men, the male sex partner, and how they might actually influence the vaginal microenvironment. In terms of disclosures, I've received research support from Hologic Incorporated, and I have served on a scientific advisory board, and I've also done the same for QIAGEN. So my plan for the next 20 minutes is to talk about men, the frequency and types of exposures that women may experience from their male partners. I'll talk about what we know about the male genital tract microbiota, and I've actually beginning to refer to this as the ignored counterpart to the vaginal microbiota. And for those of you who are a little older in the field, you might recognize this phrase because about 30 years ago, female cervicitis was referred to as the ignored counterpart to urethritis in men. Yes, exactly. So we've come full circle now. Now women are more important than men, which I actually think is probably a good thing, but we need to do a little bit more work in men. And then I'll finish up by talking a little bit about partner interactions. These are data from the most recent cycle of the National Survey of Family Growth, summarizing sexual behavior with opposite sex partners among men and women in the United States. And it's pretty clear that people are engaging in vaginal sex, 94% of the population, 94% of women and 92% of men. Oral sex is a close second. And surprisingly, a little bit to many people, anal sex is actually quite common, with about 36% of women reporting it and over 40% of men. This is heterosexual anal sex. Very interesting data. I think that one of the key things to take away from this is a report of ever having engaged in these behaviors. It tells us information about what's generally going on in the population, but nothing really about the frequency with which people engage in these behaviors. We've been doing some work in men to look at this. These are data from a poster Tishina Robinson presented yesterday, summarizing some of the work we've been doing in a cohort of heterosexual men and looking at the frequency and the incidence of these sexual behaviors. And we actually did calculate incidence from this. Men complete an electronic diary and report on their daily experience of sexual activity. And we found that the incidence of really any sexual contact between men and women is about 0.8 episodes per person week. The majority of this is vaginal sex. But they also report equal proportions, about 0.5 episodes per person week, of both partnered hand genital contact and oral sex, and this is receptive oral sex for the man or fellatio. So we're looking at this really in the interest of trying to see what types of exposures to bacterial flora that men are experiencing. We also found, looking at these data, that it's not a one-shot deal. 67% of days with sex involved more than one behavior. People aren't just engaging in one thing. This is a very colorful, slightly complicated table, but it's essentially summarizing the combinations that we observed of behaviors and then the sequence in which these behaviors occurred. And I was actually a little surprised to find that there are very consistent reports of sequencing. And to highlight our most common observation, about a third of men reported engaging in the combination of vaginal sex, hand genital contact, and insertive oral sex. And the sequence was very consistent. 84% of these men reported that hand genital contact occurred first, insertive oral sex was second, and vaginal sex was third. So in addition to the implications that this has for our future looks at the urethral microbiota, it tells us that women are experiencing very frequent exposure to skin, oral, and urethral bacteria all in a single episode. So lots of opportunities for transfer of different types of bacteria between male and female sex partners. In another group of men in our STD clinic, Laura Chambers has been looking at what characteristics are associated with non-gonococcal urethritis. And she was interested in looking at the difference between men who have sex with women and men who have sex with men. And I think one of the most striking findings that's relevant to what we're talking about this morning is an observation she saw in the men who have sex with men. Insertive anal sex at last sex was very strongly associated with NGU, an eightfold increase in risk, just an absolutely huge odds ratio. She actually wasn't able to look at this in men who have sex with women because there weren't any heterosexual men who had reported recent experience of anal sex. But we know from the NSFG data that heterosexual men do engage in anal sex, and if we assume that the mechanism for this is transfer of rectal bacteria, you would assume that the heterosexual men are experiencing the same thing. And then that also provides the opportunity for the transfer of the rectal bacteria to the female sex partner. Finally, we also know that couples use lubricants frequently when they engage in sex. We also know that exposure to lubricants may actually be disrupting the vaginal microbiota. There's some very nice data to suggest this. Sarah Romano presented a poster yesterday showing that about 40% of our male STD clinic attendees reported using lubricant at last vaginal sex. This is a relatively small sample size, so data to be interpreted cautiously, but it does look like there's a hint of a suggestion that lubricants may also be associated with idiopathic urethritis in men. So they may also be disrupting the male urethral microbiome as well. So what do we know about the male urethral microbiome? As I mentioned earlier, this really is the ignored counterpart of the vaginal microbiome. We don't know a lot. There is not a lot of published literature out there. Really, the group in Indiana, David Nelson and Dennis Fortenberry, are the group that have been working on this the longest. And they've shown in an initial look of 19 asymptomatic men using these broad-range PCR and sequencing techniques that they were able to detect 7 different bacterial phyla. This is these are plots of the relative abundance of these different bacterial groups in each of the 19 men, and each of the colors represents a different bacterial phyla. So we see kind of some variety and some consistency. They were able to identify the 25 most common bacterial genera identified in these men. And when you look at the top 5, we see some similarities with what we see in women. The most common was Lactobacillus inners, followed by Sneathia species, and then some other species that we see a little bit less commonly in women, Gamella, Aerococcus, and Carinii bacteria. They also were fortunate that a couple of these men were asymptomatically infected with chlamydia, and I think just one asymptomatically infected with gonorrhea. And so they were able to look at whether or not there is actually a difference in the urethral microbiome in men who have an STI pathogen and men who don't. And in fact, there is. If you look at the green heat map on the left-hand side, the left-hand side of this green heat map is a summary of all of the men with a chlamydial infection. And then on the right-hand side are primarily the men who don't have an STI pathogen. There are a couple of them scattered in there. And when they do this principal coordinates analysis over here on the right-hand side of the slide to see, are these groups of people really different? They're actually quite different. They separate out very clearly. The blue dots are the individuals with an STI infection, and the red are individuals without. So clearly very distinct microbial communities in men with and without STIs. The question is, which of these came first? Was it the STI that changed the urethral microbial communities, or were there urethral microbial communities already there that made these men more susceptible to acquiring these pathogens? And we actually don't know. All we know is that these things co-occur simultaneously. We need longitudinal studies to be able to figure out which came first. I want to pause for a moment and talk about species diversity, because we also see two very different things going on in women and men, or at least a suggestion that different things are going on. In women, you see this nice slide on the left, the nice graph on the left-hand side of the slide presented again by David Fredericks on the first opening plenary, very clearly showing you that women with BV on the top have this vast diversity of bacterial species, and women without BV have very low species diversity, that lactobacillus-dominated flora. In our preliminary look at men with and without NGU, we actually see the opposite. The top pie chart is men with NGU, and the bottom pie chart are the controls, men without. And men with NGU are actually characterized by less species diversity. This is more consistent with what we see in the gut. Species diversity is actually good in the gut and seems to be good for men, whereas vast species diversity in the vagina is actually not good. When we looked at this a little farther, and again, David mentioned these data, we found that these BV-associated bacteria in women are actually found in men as well. And a couple of them correlate quite well with NGU. We found that Leptotrichia sneathia species were strongly associated with NGU. We also didn't find BVAB2, BVAB3, and Megaspira very often, but when we did find those bacteria, it was almost exclusively in men with NGU. So suggesting that if these are some of the pathogens that are involved in BV, they're also potentially causing problems in men. There's some very nice work out of the Rakai group looking at the relationship between the microbiota on the penis and BV status in the female partners. They have looked at 165 uncircumcised HIV-negative men and identified 7 community state types, 3 of which they characterized as low-density community state types, and 4 of which were characterized as high-density community state types, lots of bacteria on the penis versus less bacteria. And these high-density community state types actually correlated pretty well with the BV status of their female partners. There was a prevalence rate ratio of about 1.6. So men who have these high-density community state types were more likely to have a female partner with BV, again, suggesting that there's some sharing going on. A more recent study out of the New Orleans group looked at a set of couples, men and women, where the woman had BV and then a set of normal couples where the women did not have BV. The takeaway message from this slide is to look at the intensity of the color, which reflects the strength of the correlation of the bacteria found in the man with the vaginal bacteria identified in the woman. And you can see, irrespective of whether the woman had BV in the couple or the women did not, the correlations with most of the bacteria were actually quite strong. I think the other easy takeaway message from this is that the men whose female partners had BV had dramatically higher diversity of bacterial species, lots and lots of different bacterial species here, whereas the normal couples really had a much more circumscribed group of bacteria identified in the man. And this is really borne out by the data that exist on the role of circumcision and the change in the microbial ecology in the man, as well as its relationship to partner BV status and actually acquisition of BV. The group in Rakai again demonstrated that in men who have been circumcised, their anaerobic bacteria actually decrease post-circumcision, and that's shown in this table here. You can see pre- and post-circumcision, there's actually not much of a change at all in the aerobic bacteria, but it's the anaerobic bacteria that changed dramatically pre- and post-circumcision. They also observed decreased species diversity post-circumcision, and again, we think this is good for men. Bad for men, but good for women. And this was really borne out because the female partners of circumcised men were actually less likely to go on a year later and have BV. Finally, I want to finish up by talking about infertility. And here I'm not talking about female infertility. I'm talking about male factor infertility. There is another piece of infertility. Sometimes women are infertile, but also sometimes men are infertile. And a couple of groups have looked at whether the semen microbiota might play a role in male infertility. These are the results of their analyses in their heat map. And in their hierarchical clustering, they identified a number of clusters, six clusters, in fertile and infertile men. They found that the semen microbiome was actually more diverse than the vaginal microbiota, but that there were actually lower concentrations of bacteria in the semen, so more diversity but less bacteria all the way around. And when you look at this heat map, the men who have high good quality sperm versus problems with sperm quality are the very small differences in colors along that top bar, the pink, the gray, and the black. And there's really nothing consistent going on there. They're kind of all mixed up. There really wasn't any relationship with microbial community composition and male infertility. There was only a single bacterium that they found associated with male infertility, and that was the Enterococcus. So in summary, I think we know a few things about the interplay between the male and female genital tract microbiome. We know that women are probably frequently exposed to skin, oral, and urethral flora in a single sexual encounter. We know that the urine microbiome in men with and without STI differs, but we don't know which came first. We also know that male partners of women with BV have a higher density of bacteria and similar species as their female partners. But again, we don't know which came first. Was there a change in density and species diversity in the man that was transmitted to the woman, or vice versa? We know that the healthy vaginal microbiota is less diverse, but potentially the healthy urethral microbiota might be more diverse. And this is confirmed by the data that we have observed with the role of circumcision and susceptibility to BV. And then finally, as an epidemiologist, I have to close with the observation that most of our data are cross-sectional. We really don't have the longitudinal data that we need to determine causality, and that is where we're going in the future. And as always, I'd like to thank the vast group of people that I have the privilege to work with, both individuals in the Fredericks Lab, individuals in my group that have contributed to the ongoing studies in men that we're engaged in, and of course, many of my mentors and advisors. So thank you.
Come up and use the mic. Go for it. Hi, Caroline Mitchell from Boston, Mass General. So I'm sort of struggling with how to formulate my question. Thinking about BV and whether it's sexually transmitted versus sexually facilitated, because it really doesn't seem to fit the model of a true transmitted entity. And I think about Dr. David Eschenbach from the UW did a study a long time ago now where they randomized people to have condoms sex with a condom, sex without a condom, had them come back 4 hours later and cultured the vaginal microbiota, and they didn't really see any difference with and without a condom. So I guess I'm interested in, for all of you, thoughts about transmission versus facilitation, and sort of how do we think about this, and what are the studies we need going forward to try and tease that apart? Thank you.
Come on up, Rebecca. I'll respond to that from my perspective, which is I think for David's I think there are a couple of things with David Eschenbach's study. One, I think people don't always tell the truth about their condom use. Secondly, I'm not terribly familiar with that study, but it looks like it was cultivation dependent, and now we know that there are many, many microbes out there. And then the final thing that I would say from the male perspective is that we don't even know what's there yet. So I think right now we would have a hard time figuring out what it is that is being transmitted, if it's sexual transmission. So I think we have more questions than answers still, but I know Rebecca has comments too.
I just wanted to say two things, and they're two of my favorite topics that I have not yet worked on, but I've been meaning to. It's been on my list. One is condoms have lubricant on them. And so for some women, I have a study on lubricant, and these two have extensively studied lubricant. Some women react to that lubricant, and so we're just now beginning to understand that. Also, I don't know if John Zentelman's in the audience. When I was a first-year graduate student, he wanted me to work on condom-induced latex allergy in the legal Nevada prostitutes. And so, and I went after it for a minute. If you know Dr. Zellman, you'll understand. But I think that there's a lot we don't know about how condoms affect the vaginal microenvironment.
And just to add to that, I will say, Lisa, when you mentioned that issue of lubricants affecting the male flora, I mean, maybe what it's doing is really affecting the female flora, and then that's the transmission of that altered flora is what you're seeing. So a very interesting potential causal pathway. Rupert.
Hey, I had a fairly focused question, actually. It was for Lisa, so I thought it was a fantastic review. I guess one was a comment, and sometimes I got confused what was foreskin microbiome and what was urethral microbiome, mm-hmm. but I do think definitely we know very little about, especially urethral microbiome. Mm-hmm. And it was just clarification, really. At first I wrote down, and I was taking some little notes over there because I didn't know anything about it, and I wrote, I know, male urethral diversity, good. And then later on I saw you, I think you were saying that a male partner of a woman with BV had a more diverse urethral microbiome, which said to me, oh, maybe that more diverse microbiome bad. So I went back and I crossed out and thought I must have heard it wrong. And then at the end of your summary I saw that, no, I had got it right the first time around. So I just wasn't clear, how are you saying good or, like, what's good or bad? And I would have thought that if a urethral microbiome is more diverse of a female partner with BV, then diversity would be bad. So I'm just not that clear on how we're defining good and bad.
Yeah, that's probably my fault for using very loosely the terms good and bad. the first point of clarification is that our observation of the increased species diversity in men without NGU was the urethral microbiota, and the observation in the studies in Rakai are actually the penile microbiota. And I think one of the things we do know is that those anatomic compartments are actually quite different. The diversity that was observed in the circumcision studies was really related to whether or not the woman had BV. So it was the male diversity that, I'm getting confused. That's very embarrassing. But I think the key takeaway message is that it is different body compartments, and that I think we honestly don't know whether diversity is good or bad. I think what we've observed is that in the urethra, it's different from what it looks like it might be different in what's observed in the vagina. I think it's pretty clear that diversity is higher species diversity is associated with BV. So that was my bad classification, but I think there's a lot we still just really don't know.
So at the end of the day, what you're telling me is that I shouldn't come away with a simple good bad message. It's more complicated than that.
It always is when you're talking about the vaginal microflora. I just one thing to add to that. I mean, really, what Rupert's question brings up to me and reminds me is that we really don't know what the upstream source of these bacteria are. The prostate. is a completely understudied area and may be very important in terms of harboring bacteria. We know that it's susceptible to really interesting infections like Cryptococcus, PCP, weird stuff. So it may also be an interesting place where it's nice and anaerobic and there could be some focus of stuff that we then see further down the stream, literally. Sedgi.
So maybe you all have talked about this, but you know, it's obviously not easy material for me, and I get all confused listening to everything, trying to focus on everything. But can we compare women with 50-plus partners to women with one or two partners and find differences in their vaginal microbiota? Mm-hmm. And then I would repeat the same question for men.
You mean lifetime partners? Or just recent partners or whatever? Because well, a lifetime partner, I think, would be very interesting.
I do not know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's lifetime.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the past 1 year. Maybe it's the past... I mean, the research is supposed to
really
define the relevant time period for me.
Any
question. Of that. I'll take any.
It's a great question. I would say we haven't
done that. I'm almost positive we haven't done it. We certainly haven't for men. Rebecca may know differently
for
women.
I think we've been having a party sort of trying to describe the microbiome component, and we have kind of, as you and I have talked about, not really gotten sophisticated about the behavioral side of this analysis, which is something that we really need to write that editorial that we've been talking about writing for decades. Becca, do you agree?
Please.
Do you want to?
Yeah, no. Lifetime number of partners is a variable that I often use, and it's a pretty good measure of risk. But the one thing I was going to add is that women who have one or two partners and are married might have a lot more sex than someone who has number of partners, more frequent sex. And so it's really hard to study. And I always say, and I've had a philosophy about BV for a long time, and I don't know if I should lay it out, but I kind of feel like it's something that might have happened. For example, if you're interested in studying receptive oral sex in a woman, I can't just study it on a Tuesday and see what happened in the vaginal microbiome on Wednesday necessarily, because I might have needed to study it 10 years ago when she first met that bad partner. The source partner. I like that word better. The source partner. I'll use that word in my paper. Yeah. And so it's so difficult to study. We don't have a 20-year study of following a woman from sexual debut. Carolyn Mitchell did sexual debut, but we need to follow those women farther.
Yeah. And nice work from Cal Bradshaw's group in Australia showing that sexual debut clearly does alter the flora initially. And so maybe that is the set point, you know, that we're really trying to work from. So we have a couple more minutes just with Christine and then Kathy, and maybe we should wrap it up.
Great. Hi, Christine Johnson from University of Washington. Thanks to all speakers for a great session. My question is for Christina and Rebecca. Christina, thank you for laying out the biofilm, and you showed some beautiful images. I'm having a hard time reconciling that biofilm, which I think of as a really impenetrable layer, with the increased risk of STI. So maybe both of you can comment on that.
That's a good question.
Yeah. I'm just going to say one thing. I'm not an expert on biofilm, although I followed the literature a bit. I will just tell you that having been a student of Richard Cohn, he's very skeptical of the biofilm literature, primarily because of mucus, because mucus flows. And he said that he basically taught me that if there is a biofilm, that it's just basically that the bacteria are just elongating and grabbing onto the next bacteria. But there's a constant, remember, the vagina is a constant flow. It's a dynamic system. And so... I will just add that I think there's a lot of work to be done in biofilm, so if anyone wants to do it, they should do it. But it's a hard study to do because you have to do, like, we've talked about doing, like, punch biopsies on women, and, they're difficult studies, so I'll give it to Christine.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a million-dollar question. I don't think we have the answer to it. This biofilm research just started, 10 years ago, really, and we're on the very cusp of it. But remember, I said that some of these organisms are detaching from the biofilm, so it is a very fluctuating community. And so no one has studied the natural history of a BV biofilm. And so I don't know exactly what is happening to that biofilm over time and how that can influence someone's risk for STD acquisition. I think a study like that needs to be done.
And what I'd add to that is that we don't even know what the situation is at the cervix, where endocervical columnar epithelium is with chlamydia gonorrhea, which really is where the target cells are. Obviously not the same for herpes, but, you know, is the biofilm sort of just creating a safe passage for those pathogens by taking out and continuing to take out the lactobacilli so they just have a clear, you know, route to the vulnerable cells that they're trying to get? I don't know. It's a great question. Kathy Hsu, you can close the whole thing.
That was really incredible. And so I'm Kathy Hsu. I'm from BU Medical Center and Mass Department of Public Health, and I'm a pediatric infectious disease specialist by training. And I'm just stimulated by this entire symposium to think about it from the pediatric and adolescent perspective and what we're understanding about allergy and immunology and the timing of diversity exposure from the microbiome as it influences, for example, the development of allergic reactions to peanuts and so on and so forth. So as I'm struck by that, I'm thinking about the timing of the sexual debut and the timing of maybe diversity is a good thing at certain times, but not at other times. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is more of a comment and just a thank you to all of you for bringing this area.
Thanks so much. And I think it's a great way to stop. How many of you have read the New England Journal paper comparing the allergic reactivity of the Mennonites versus the Amish? Fascinating paper. So let's think about a vaginal microbiota study to replicate that. Thank you, Sevgi, for helping us get this together. And thank you so much to our fantastic speakers and to the audience.